podcast, home to stories that haunt. These stories may contain graphic depictions of violence or explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Dad's dead.
Hello?
I'd almost dropped the phone.
Who is this?
It's Sal, duh.
My sister's flat tone was clearer now.
Sal, hi. Hey, what did you say? I totally misheard you there.
I tucked the phone against my shoulder and went back to raking through the papers in my desk drawer looking for my favorite pen. Sal sighed.
I said,
she snapped,
Dad's dead.
Then I did drop the phone. When I got to the house, it was swarming with police. Two squad cars in a van were parked in the gravel at the front. About 12 officers were there, talking into radios and mobiles, trying windows. Three were shoving over and over on the front door. An ambulance was parked there too. The paramedics were at the study window, hands cupped around faces looking in. Periodically, one or the other would knock on the glass and shout. My sister was perched on the stone balustrade beside the front steps, smoking.
Sal? David?
Sal's tone was still flat.
Where is he? What's happening?
Inside. She flicked ash and took another deep draw.
You said he was dead.
Oh, he is dead, Sal said. He's at his desk in a lake of blood. She nodded to where the paramedics were still calling out.
Go, see for yourself. But what's happening? Why is everyone milling about? Why aren't the paramedics in there helping him?
Yeah, she laughed, humorlessly. He's way past helping. Besides, it's all locked up. They can't get in. Hearing this, I ran past her, up the steps and called out to the officers there.
Hello,
I said. There's
a key here.
I kicked over the flower pot and stooped to grab the key, but it wasn't there.
Who are you?
The nearest officer asked, taking his notebook from its clip.
David Marsh, I said. I'm the son. I mean, this is my dad's house. I was going to get you the key.
I saw it now. It was already in the door.
But I see you found it already.
Right, the officer said.
And what brings you here today? What do you mean?
I was almost shouting.
My dad! My sister says he's dead! Does she indeed?
The policeman looked briefly around me at where Sal was lighting another cigarette from the stub of the first.
Well?
I demanded.
Is he? That remains to be seen,
the officer said.
Now tell me, is there another means of fastening this door? What do you mean? Like a second lock?
The officer nodded.
No.
I shook my head.
Yes, there's a bolt at the top, but nothing with a key. This one says it's bolted inside, Gov.
The officer called to a man in a leather jacket and jeans who was talking into a mobile phone beside the closest squad car.
Does he know?
The man called back dismissively. Then he resumed talking into his phone. I walked away from them, towards the window where the paramedics were still knocking. It's a big house. A red sandstone 18th century mansion, far too enormous for one man. But Dad likes ostentation. Or at least, he'd seem to get a taste for it after he and our mother divorced. I've stayed here once or twice, but have never been able to call it my home. He lived in a one-bed apartment when Sal and I were still young enough to be expected to spend every other weekend with him. We'd slept on his uncomfortable designer sofa for those years, taking turns weekend abouts so that we didn't have to share it. It was only when Sal and I had become adults that he decided that he needed an 8-bed, 6-bath mansion with stables and tennis courts and a pool. When I reached the bay window, I went to the pane that didn't already have a paramedic at it, and cupping my hands around my face against the light, I looked in. And there he was, as Sal had said, slumped at his desk in a large pool of blood. It had formed a black puddle covering most of the tabletop and dripped into a lumpy-looking slick on the rug at the closest edge. Dad was seated on the other side of the desk from where I stood. He liked to look out the window as he worked. Beside his hand was the remote for the vibrating collar he used on the dog. Behind him, on the floor, half under the coffee table in the corner of the room, I thought I could see the shining barrel of a rifle. "I'm going to check on the cleaner," one paramedic said to the other. I gazed after him and then followed as he went to the open back of the ambulance. Maria, Dad's housekeeper, sat on the edge, wrapped in a blanket, crying.
"Oh, David!"
she screeched, seeing me.
"Oh, David, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, David. I couldn't get in. He's in a bad way, David. A very bad way."
I sat down beside her. "What happened?" I asked. I felt weirdly numb, like I was in a play and merely acting out a part.
"I came,"
she sniffed noisily.
"Just as usual. I do the brass on Thursdays once a month, like, so I was a bit early. But I couldn't get in. I had my keys, of course, but he'd bolted every door. You know what Tara's like."
Tara is my dad's dog. She's very good at opening doors.
But he's always up by the time I get here. He's always opened the front, at least."
She paused and took a few gulps of air.
"But I couldn't get in, so I thought he must have forgotten to unbolt one. So I went round the windows knocking, and then I saw him in..."
Her voice cracked, and she broke into sobs again.
In all that blood. I called 999. I thought if I was fast, they'd be able to do something."
She looked up at the milling crowd of emergency workers and shook her head sadly.
"But they can't get in either."
Fire engine came rolling down the drive then, and after a short hubbub, four burly firefighters and a large metal ram got the front door open. Tara came bounding out and immediately started snapping around their feet at their shoes, much to the alarm of some of the officers.
"Stop!"
I shouted, running towards them as they tried to grab her and kick her by turns. Luckily, I was upwind. She smelled me as I got near and left them alone, scampering over to me and tucking her tail in a submissive hello. I bent and stroked her, wondering what she'd been going through.
"Bloody weird dog,"
one of the officers was shouting.
"Never made a sound when we were trying to get in. She's deaf,"
I called out.
"She couldn't hear you trying to get in."
Tara had been deaf from birth. She was almost blind too. A victim of the fad for merle-colored dogs. She was a double merle, a fatal crossing. The only survivor of a litter of nine. She was circling me now, trying to chew on my shoelaces. She has a thing for shoelaces. The police and paramedics had all piled inside now, so I went in after them, heading for the back door and Tara's leash, which had been hung beside it on a hook. As I passed the study on the way back, I couldn't stop myself from looking in. A paramedic, gloved hand to my father's throat, was shaking her head. The gov was taking a phone from his pocket, and as he spoke into it,
"Get crime scene over here."
Our eyes met, and he tilted his head slightly, giving me an odd look as if I shouldn't be there. But he wasn't surprised that I was. Sal took Tara into hers. There's nobody else but me in my flat, and the police immediately asked us to go to the station to be fingerprinted and give initial statements. But Sal's wife, Jill, was happy to have Tara, so we dropped her there on the way. I'd not been fingerprinted since school, when the police came to give a talk on policing and let us meet the bomb detector dogs. It was sort of a gimmick, I'd thought back then. But maybe they kept them on file in case you were kidnapped or grew up to be a criminal. Anyway, back then, it had been a paper card and an ink block. Now, it was a sensor attached by a wire to a laptop. When mine were done, they put me in an interview room alone. After about half an hour, an officer came in and put a manila folder down on the table and asked if I wanted a drink.
A coffee,
I asked.
Black, no sugar.
See what I can find, she replied, and left, leaving the file on the table. I know what you're thinking. But of course I looked in it. Maybe you could resist, but in that case, you're a better man than I. I think I lasted about 2 minutes before I flipped it open. In the front, there were a few gruesome shots of what was left of my dad. His face was surprisingly intact, but the rest was... Well, if you imagine a motorcycling helmet with the visor flipped up, but then take the helmet out of the picture and replace the visor with a huge opening, shredded brain, and shards of bone exposed, you're about there. I looked at them only briefly, then put them in a pile face down to one side. I scanned through the handwritten notes behind the pics. Nothing illuminating, really. His name, address, the circumstances, my name, Sal's, and Mum's, with deceased written beside it. I heard footsteps approaching and put it all back the way it had been, rotating it to face the empty chair opposite just as the door opened.
You've been having a little look.
It was the Gov from outside the house again, without his leather jacket, and the officer who'd left the file. She put a cup of steaming black coffee down in front of me and gave me a tight apologetic smile.
Curiosity killed the cat, I know,
I shrugged.
Honest, the Gov said. I like that.
Yeah, well.
I slid my eyes up to the camera in the corner of the ceiling.
Sometimes honesty's the best policy.
The officer followed my look and smiled again, wider this time.
D.I. Bell,
the Gov introduced himself.
This is D.S. Michaels.
He nodded towards his colleague.
David Marsh,
I said, then sipped the coffee. It was good.
As you know, Mr. Marsh,
D.I. Bell said,
your father was found dead this morning, and at the moment, we're treating it as a murder.
Yeah, no shit.
I widened my eyes. What was this guy on?
You don't seem very sad, Mr. Marsh,
Bell noted. I shrugged.
He's a complicated man,
I said.
I'm not sure sad is the right word for how I feel. Tell me about him.
D.I. Bell leaned forward. He was tall, with an excruciatingly manicured beard. I rubbed my own stubble, considering how to describe it.
I do love him,
I opened with, the but advancing itself across the table before I could say it.
But he's difficult.
Difficult.
Twisted.
I just laid it out.
He's slightly twisted.
Twisted how? D.S. Michaels this time. She too was leaning forward towards me.
Well,
I cast about for an example.
Okay, here. He's homophobic, right? But he's not openly homophobic because he likes to pretend he's beyond reproach. My sister Sal came out to everyone when she was about 15. Mum made a cake because it was brave of Sal back then, and, well, we all like cake. Then we all just got on with life. And Dad, he set up a trust fund to pay for her wedding. Talked about it for years. Over 100K in it, he said. All ready for when she wanted to settle down. Could pay for a fairy tale, a Disney dream wedding, blah, blah, blah. And when she was engaged to Jill, that's her wife, she went to ask him about it. And it turned out he'd set it up so that it could only be used for a marriage, not a civil union.
And this was pre-2014, Michaels asked.
Yeah, 2010. So they had a civil union, which was all they could have, and paid for it themselves. But it crushed her. You have to understand how personal this was. She has never dated a boy. She has only ever been gay. He knew exactly what he was doing, and when they were changing the law and you could have your civil union converted to a marriage, suddenly the trust didn't exist anymore. He'd dissolved it.
I slurped more coffee. I could feel it flowing through me, warming my bones and quickening my blood.
I'm not certain, because I've not seen, but I'd be willing to bet that he set up that trust right when she came out, and then dissolved it the day they announced they were legalizing gay marriage. He's twisted like that. It's not about the money. That would have been nothing to him, even back then. It's the way he used it, turned it into a weapon every time. When Mum asked him for a divorce, he made her sign an agreement that she'd never ask him for money. Made it sound like it was about alimony. Told her not to worry about a lawyer. But it wasn't. It was the divorce settlement. So when it all went through, she got nothing. He had two kids with her, and we lived in a one-bed flat paid for with her nursing wages. We'd take turns going to his at the weekend because he liked to divide and conquer, and he'd take us out on steak dinners or lobster, to race supercars or ride horses or for private shopping at Hamleys. But he lived in a one-bed luxury flat back then, so we'd never actually be able to live with him. He just liked to hold it over her, remind her constantly how much better he could provide for us. I think he thought it'd make us love him. It had the opposite effect.
So you didn't get along? D.I. Bell asked. I sighed, then paused for a while. It was hard to qualify my feelings.
Look, I do love him. He's my dad. But I don't like him at all.
I stabbed my fingers into the tabletop for emphasis.
For all his wealth and influence, he's a cruel, sad, small man, heart the size of a raisin. I pity him, and he hates that.
But you have keys to his house, D.S. Michaels again.
Did Sal tell you that?
Neither of them replied.
She's wrong. I did have keys. He'd been traveling. I was supposed to go in and feed Tara, let her out.
And did you?
No. I went and picked her up as soon as he'd gone and took her back to mine. He insists that she has to stay there because she's deaf and nearly blind and won't cope in another house, but she coped fine after the first day. He just wanted to think of her there alone in the dark and in the silence, missing him.
I'd finished the coffee now and put the cup down pointedly, hoping they'd offer me another.
But he took the keys back when he came home. I was more welcome in his house when he wasn't there than when he was.
D.I. Bell's phone rang, and he stepped out to answer it. Then the angelic D.S. Michaels offered me a second coffee.
What do you think happened to your father?
D.S. Michaels had clearly been told to take over for a bit now. D.I. Bell leaned back in his chair, doodling on his notepad as he listened.
I think he was shot in the head,
I said.
But for full disclosure, I did look through the window and take a glance at all those photos.
I nodded towards the folder.
And there was a gun on the floor. Plus, I'm not sure what else could have caused that damage.
Who do you think did it?
That's a hard one. He had plenty of enemies.
Really? She tilted her head.
Who? Well, almost everyone who'd ever have dealings with him. His neighbors hate him. He discovered the property deed was 8 feet out along a 3-mile road. He made them dig up their hedges and replace expensive stone dike walls to correct it. I think they were genuinely shocked by him doing it. The countryside is full of errors like that. Most of the time people laugh it off, pay a bottle of something as rent every Christmas. It had been like that for decades, maybe longer. And there was no water there, no access to anything, nothing worth having. Most people are just happy to have a good neighborly relationship over a few feet of mud, but not Dad. He went straight to his lawyer. Is that the Wilson Edgertons to the east?
D.S. Michaels was writing notes too. I nodded.
Speaking of names,
D.I. Bell interjected.
Why are you Marsh and not Frankton? I decided I didn't want his name when I was a teenager,
I said.
Took my mother's maiden name instead.
You must have really hated him then.
It wasn't a question.
Well,
I shrugged.
Teenagers, you know. Dramatic. Okay, who else?
D.S. Michaels wrestled the conversation back.
Oh, I looked up at the ceiling, thinking.
The woman who runs the local pony club. They used to use the school and paddocks around his stables for their winter meetups and their annual show. Gymkhana, that what it's called? Dad put a stop to it. Told them he had plans for the property there. Turns out his plan was to keep it empty. The dog breeder he got Tara from. He insisted on a Merle crossing, then sued her for the vet bills when the inevitable happened and she had all kinds of health problems. She's a silly woman, but he can be horrible. He sort of steamrolls people into doing things they normally wouldn't, and then makes them pay for the pleasure. There's a couple of car dealerships he's done that sort of thing to as well. Honestly, you'd be better asking who definitely wouldn't have done it. He can't help himself. He's a nasty man. He's like that story about the frog and the scorpion. He's poisonous. He can't help himself.
I paused.
Couldn't help himself,
I corrected. D.S. Michaels inclined her head slightly at this. I had a vague recollection of a TV psychiatrist saying that the tense someone uses about a murdered person can indicate guilt or not, but I couldn't recall which tense meant what.
What about your sister? D.I. Bell interrupted.
Sal? I laughed.
There's no way. Why not? It doesn't sound as if she had much of a relationship with your dad. Perhaps she's borne a grudge for the wedding thing.
I was already shaking my head.
Tons of reasons. Firstly, we don't hate our dad. We love him, and we pity him. That's how Mum couched it when we were growing up. He had so much, but the few things that really matter, he didn't have, couldn't have. We felt sorry for him. He's a sort of tragic figure, not someone to destroy. I mean, he destroys everything good himself. And secondly, Sal hates guns. She can't shoot at all. She could have rested the muzzle on the back of his head and still missed. And what about yourself?
There was a note of triumph that shocked me in his voice.
It wasn't me,
I shrugged.
Can you shoot?
D.S. Michaels again now.
Yes,
I paused.
Yes, I can shoot. Dad and I shoot together a few times a year, mostly pheasant, the odd deer in season, of course.
Is that why your prints are on the gun?
There it was, I thought. There's the source of the triumph.
Was it one of his guns?
I asked.
I've fired most of them. I'd not be surprised if my prints were on all of them.
Only your prints are on it,
D.I. Bell smiled.
Right,
I faltered. I knew nothing about fingerprinting.
And is that rare? Is that not typical?
The house was all locked up.
He ignored my questions.
Doors bolted from the inside. How do you think the perpetrator got in or out?
I shrugged.
No ideas?
He pressed.
Do I need a lawyer?
I asked.
I don't know, Mr. Marsh.
There was a hint of sarcasm in his tone.
Do you? Look,
I held my hands up in surrender.
I do want to help. I didn't do this. It'd be good to know what happened, but I feel like you might have an agenda here.
If you want to help, then just keep answering the questions, D.S. Michaels said, her tone much more soothing.
But am I a suspect?
I persisted.
There are no suspects at this stage, and everyone is a person of interest.
D.S. Michaels wasn't looking at me.
Can you please tell us, if someone wanted to get in and out, how they would do it? I don't... Look, Mr. Marsh, we have a lot of people we need to talk to. The sooner you answer our questions, the sooner you can be out of here, and we can start cracking on with finding your dad's killer. All the doors were bolted.
I heard myself ask. They nodded.
And the windows were locked.
More nods. I thought about it for a while.
The small cloak bathroom,
I said.
What was that window lock screwed in?
They looked at one another. D.S. Michaels took out a phone and began scrolling through photos.
Which window?
She asked, holding the phone towards me. The mudroom was pictured.
See that paneled wall
I pointed at the end wall with its row of empty brass hooks.
That's a false wall. You press on it, and it opens. There's a little bathroom in there, just a loo, and a small sink. The window in there has one of those catches you screw to close it. A Brighton sash fastener, I think you call it.
Right.
Well, he never screws it in, but whenever you close it, the bolt falls into the catch and sticks, so it's effectively locked even when nobody actually locked it.
Michaels scribbled this frantically, then stood.
I'm going to call the guys on the scene, she said. Get them to check this out. You stand to inherit a lot of money from your father's estate,
D.I. Bell said as the door closed behind Michaels.
Knowing my father, no,
I said, but absent-mindedly. I'd finally begun to come to my senses.
But he was substantially wealthy,
he went on.
Yourself and Sally are surely about to become millionaires. Are you going to arrest me?
I asked.
We're just talking,
he smirked slightly. He wasn't very good at interviewing, I thought.
So I'm free to go.
He gestured a hand towards the door in a feel-free motion, and I stood.
We know where to find you when we need to talk to you again, he said,
not veiling the threat. Sal and I met in the car park, and were both surprised that the other had also been kept so long. We drove back to hers in silence, both lost in our own wanderings. Maybe she was wondering if I'd done it. In her small, bright kitchen, we sat at their turquoise formica table, and Jill made us a strong, sweet tea for the shock.
Well,
she asked,
what did they say? They think I did it,
I said.
No, they think I did it,
Sal countered.
That's not how they made it sound to me.
I swigged the tea, welcoming the scorch of it in my throat.
Did someone do it then?
Jill asked.
It was a murder. It must have been.
Sal buried her face in her hands, muffling her voice.
He was shot in the back of the head. But who? Who would do that?
Jill was a sweet woman, too kind to imagine the cruelty others can inflict.
God knows. The queue of candidates is long enough,
Sal said.
Well, if they interview all of them for as long as they did us, even if the guilty party confesses as soon as they ask, it's going to take them a decade to find out.
I laughed, and Sal gave me a tight smile.
I wish Mum was here, she said.
Our mum had died 2 years prior. Bloaty, achy stomach had been stage 4 ovarian cancer, and she'd died 7 weeks after her first trip to the doctor about it.
Me too,
I said, reaching over and giving Sal's bony fingers a squeeze. I stayed at Sal's. That evening, we informed the lawyer of Dad's death, but then we stalled out on actions to take. The lawyer's name was about all we knew without access to Dad's study, and the house was still a crime scene. Tara was unhappy. She had refused to eat. She had established a clear path from one side of the living room to the other and spent the night pacing it back and forth, back and forth. I lay in my underwear on the sofa under a thin comforter, staring at the ceiling and thinking about Dad's brains on his desk. I could hear her swallowing over and over. Poor dog must have had a shit time, locked in the house with his corpse. When she passed, I stuck a hand out, tried to pet her, but she cowered away from my touch and resumed her pacing. Around 5 a.m., I gave up trying to sleep and got up to make a coffee. When the pot was brewed and the first cup in my hand, I happened to glance out of the window just when a police car pulled up. I felt my shoulders slump. They were here for one of us, I was sure. When the buzzer went, I answered and pressed the door release button without speaking. Sal came out into the hall from her bedroom, bleary-eyed and wild-haired.
Who is it?
She sounded frantic.
The police,
I said. When I opened the door, I was gratified to see D.I. Bell look like I felt, exhausted. He was with 2 uniformed officers.
David Marsh and Detective Inspector Davy Bell. I'm arresting you on suspicion of the murder of David Johannes Frankton. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention when questioned something that you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence. Do you understand?
I do, I said.
Do I need to ask the boys to cuff you?
He asked. I looked at the burly uniformed men standing behind him.
No, it's fine. I'll come.
Can I get dressed? I jerked my chin over my shoulder towards the living room, and he nodded. The three of them crowded clumsily into the hall while I ran and threw my clothes back on. In the corner, Tara had stopped pacing and was trying to throw up, white foam flowing out of her mouth.
Sal,
I called as I went back out to where the officers stood.
Tara needs a vet. I think she might be bloating. I'll get you a lawyer,
she called back, emerging from the bedroom, still bedraggled looking, but dressed.
Don't speak until they arrive. Okay, but listen, vet first, yeah? She looks really ill.
Back at the station, I was relieved of my shoelaces and put in a cell. I lay on the little bench and stared at the ceiling, wondering what would happen next. I'd seen on another show once an accused murderer being offered a paperback novel and a coffee, but that didn't happen to me. After about 3 hours, I was brought a limp cheese sandwich and a lukewarm tea for breakfast. Then I waited again for another eternity. I was surprised when they finally took me into the interview room to see that it was only 11:30. Mr. Marsh, D.S. Michaels looked better than D.I. Bell. Well, she looked like she had slept and eaten anyway.
Where were you between 6 p.m. on Tuesday and 6 a.m. on Wednesday? What? Has he been dead all that time?
I thought about Tara again. Poor dog.
Answer the question, please, Mr. Marsh.
She sounded robotic. I thought about it.
I was at home. The whole time?
She arched an eyebrow.
The whole time. I was playing Crash Bandicoot.
When she stared blankly at this information, I clarified.
On the PlayStation. Fucking Stormy Ascent. Trying to heal an old wound.
This clearly meant nothing to her.
A game, she said. Alone?
Yes, I was alone, I said.
But I think it logs me in automatically when I turn it on.
She made a note of this.
We know you shot your father, Mr. Marsh, she said. And it would be better for you to tell us your side now. I didn't shoot my father. Your fingerprints are on the gun, she said. And when we examined the bathroom window you directed us to, your fingerprints were on the brass lifters there too. The paint.
I remembered now.
Paint. It was painted shut last year,
I said.
Dad did it. Very unusual for him to attempt any DIY. He asked me to free it for him about 6 weeks ago. I cut the paint with a box cutter, heaved it open by the lifters.
I thought about that episode, and recalled the time last year when we'd gone out to shoot an old ailing stag he'd seen in the edge of his woods. He'd been weird about his gun, refused to take it from me when I'd taken the shot, shouted at me to put it back in the Land Rover myself. That old bastard.
Suicide,
I announced.
I beg your pardon?
She sounded incredulous.
I don't know how he did it,
I said.
But this is deliberate. He's set me up. And why would he do that? I told you, he was warped. He threatened once that he'd frame me. He threatened a lot of things. You're saying your father, in order to frame you for murder, shot himself in the back of his own head from 15 feet away?
D.I. Bell was pissed off. I shrugged and nodded. He rose slightly from his chair, jerking his chin at Michaels to tell her to follow.
Take him back down,
he said to the officer outside the door. I was returned to the tiny cell. I was told I'd missed lunch, which I decided might be a tactic. I could hear others shouting in their cells, their voices clattering around in the corridor outside, but I stayed quiet. I was thinking. Around 3, a young officer opened the door.
Phone call for you,
he announced, holding out a wireless handset.
Hello?
I said into it.
Dave?
It was Sal.
Listen, I'm sorry about the waiting. I've got a lawyer coming this evening. Are you okay?
I'm fine, I said. What's the lawyer called?
I don't know. Sands something. It's a woman. Someone Jill's mum went to school with. I've had to leave Tara at the vet, Dave. It's not looking great. They think her gut has twisted.
Yeah, she looked sick, I said. It'll be the stress.
Do you know, they think he died Tuesday night. She'd been with him hours.
I know.
Well, the building manager told me. He said they'd requested the door CCTV for Tuesday into Wednesday. I guess that's why they've arrested you and not me. I must be on it. What were you doing then? Tell me you were out with someone.
Yeah, no such luck, I said. I was on my ass on my sofa playing Crash Bandicoot.
Shit, Dave.
She said, her voice quiet, sad.
Shit.
I know. Look, thanks for sorting the lawyer.
I'll call you when I can, okay?
Let me know how the dog gets on, yeah? Dinner was another floppy cheese sandwich, a bottle of tepid water, and a packet of prawn cocktail-flavored crisps. I could have eaten it three times over by then. Another officer came just after I'd finished it to take me up to see my lawyer. Diane Sanderson. She offered a hand, which I shook. It was warm and self-assured. David Marsh, I replied. Did you kill your father? She asked, her hand poised over a pad of paper, pen hovering.
Only answer if you didn't.
No, I laughed a bit. I really didn't.
It says here you've no alibi.
She pulled a face.
No, sorry. I was vegging at home playing a video game.
An online game? She leaned forward.
A collaborative game?
No, I shook my head.
I might have been online, like logged in, but I wasn't playing with anyone else. Maybe my phone will help. Will it show I was there?
She slumped a little, wrote something on a notebook.
Okay. Well, any idea who did kill him? Was it definitely, definitely murder?
I asked.
Are you asking if he shot himself in the back of his own head from across the room?
Look, I said,
I know how it sounds, but you have to understand the sort of man he was. He was clever, and he was perverse. This is exactly the sort of thing he'd do.
I'll mention it to the DI, she said.
But I'd not hold your breath on them taking that too seriously.
I've already mentioned it, I said. They locked me up with no lunch.
Look, can't you get scene photos or something? We could work out how we did it.
Are you hungry? She didn't want to engage with this, I realized.
A bit,
I said.
They gave me dinner, though, don't worry. I'll see what I can do,
she said, and slipped out of the room.
I hope you like fish and chips,
she said when she came back in.
You're kidding. How did you swing that?
My mouth was watering just at the words.
Sent one of the desk sergeants across the road for them. He owes me.
She opened her file then, clearly not going to elaborate.
Now, let's have a look and see how you can be defended.
It wasn't all doom and gloom. She was cheered by the idea that the PlayStation might have logged me in, and that my phone was on, and that I couldn't recall specifically, but it was likely that I'd at least checked the time on it sometime in there.
There won't be evidence of him at mine,
I said.
Okay. And, I mean, surely if I shot him, I'd have had blood or something on me, so it'd be in my house.
Well, she flapped her file closed.
Let's see what forensics do come up with.
Tara was full of cord,
Sal was shouting. The eyebrows on the officer who'd brought me the phone rose. Clearly he could hear her as well as I could. It was now Saturday morning. I had spent the night in the cell at the station. A low hum of discomfort in my lower back from the hard bench was niggling at me.
and I needed a shave.
You what?
Cord. That bloody deer tendon rope Dad used to make. But miles and miles of it, Dave. About 30 feet or something. It was all through her, tangling her guts up.
Bloody weird, I replied. Is she going to be okay?
They don't know.
Sal sounded tired.
Is she insured? The operation they did is going to cost thousands.
Knowing Dad, she will have been, I said. I'm sure lifetime insurance costs were part of the settlement he won against the breeder. Can you get in the house yet? The papers will be in there if they exist.
No, it's still a crime scene. I'll see if I can put the vets off for a bit. She's still in anyway, on IV fluids and loads of drugs. How was the lawyer?
Yeah, she seems good, I said. Thank Jill for me. Any news about Dad yet? From the pathologist or whoever it is that has him, I mean?
The police want me to come in and talk about it this morning.
Sal paused.
Have they said anything to you?
They won't tell me anything. I chuckled. They're waiting for me to tell them something.
And? Have you?
I could tell it was hurting her to ask. Sal, I decided this was the moment. I know this is going to sound insane, but I think he might have killed himself.
Oh,
I know. I spoke fast. She sounded shocked, and I needed her to understand. Look, I know. It's just, you know I'd never do this. He was a twisted bastard, and I'm wondering if he rigged something up. Something with the cord Tara 8, maybe. Can the police get it from the vet?
I don't know.
Look, forget I said it.
No, wait.
Sal said.
Dave, did he ever talk about his death with you? Really talk about it, I mean.
Not really. I thought about it. Not unless you count the endless threats to disinherit me. Knowing him, I was never in the will anyway. He'll have left it all to a donkey sanctuary or some right-wing extremist group or something, just to get at us.
Dave, listen.
There was an urgency in her voice now.
He did talk about it with me. He said, I can't remember his exact words, but he said something like, I've got a big surprise in store for you at the end, you and your brother. But he emphasized you, brother, like that, like... Do you think it means something?
God knows, I said. I could tell the officer was getting impatient. Knowing him, anything is possible. Look, I think I have to go. See if you can come see me when you're here, okay? Sal replied, but I didn't hear what she said as the officer took the phone out of my hand. All right, Mr. Marsh. It was D.I. Bell at the cell door. Out you come. Are you going to charge me? Hours had gone by, and Sal still hadn't come to see me. Maybe they'd refused to let her. No, Mr. Marsh. You're free to go. Wait, what? I was stunned. What's happened? Have you arrested someone else? Your sister is waiting for you upstairs. He didn't sound happy. I'm sure she'll fill you in. Back in the cozy kitchen of their flat, Jill put a plate of chicken curry in front of me, and Sal filled me in. It was him, she said breathlessly. You were right, it was all him. But how? I asked thickly around a mouthful of food. Well, right after I spoke to you, I called them. I didn't wait to come in. I told them about Tara's operation, the cord the vet took out, and what he'd said about a big surprise. Then I asked them if he could have set it up somehow. They didn't reply, just told me not to come back until a bit later. But then when I got there, they were waiting for the pathologist to get back to them about something. She was at the house, apparently. Anyway, it took forever, but finally she came and she said she'd found evidence he'd done it to himself, and she was ruling it a suicide. But how? They said he'd set the gun up on the armchairs back behind the desk,
strung his smelly deer cord from the trigger through two brass eyelets screwed into the doorframe in the wall and then onto the door handle. The one on the wall is behind that ugly house plant he has. There were little wedges of card under edges of the mirrors, angling them so that when he sat at the desk, he could see the back of his own head, line it up with the red dot of the laser sight on the rifle. They said he got it all set up so that the door opening would pull the trigger, got the dot where he wanted it. Then he pressed the button on the remote to tell Tara to come. As soon as she pushed on the door, it shot him. They think she just ate the cord because it was deer tendon, and she must have been hungry in there with him dead all those hours.
Wow. I sat back and considered it.
Fiendish? But why? Well, that's another thing.
Sal was vibrating, her fingers flying.
Did you know he was riddled with cancer?
I shook my head.
They think that's why he chose now. And the will? Well, that really convinced them. You can't inherit if you kill someone, right? So he'd left absolutely everything to you. And you're supposed to give me what you think I deserve. But of course, he wrote that thinking he was so clever that you'd never get it anyway. Then we'd both be double fucked. You, poor and in jail. Me, poor and hating you. God, he really hated us, didn't he?
I scraped my plate clean.
How much is there? 37 million,
Sal grinned.
Plus the house, that's about another three. And the lawyer says he thinks there's assets elsewhere that he needs to dig around for. How's Tara?
I suddenly remembered.
Well, yeah, she's okay. She should be all right once she's healed. The vet says she can come home tomorrow.
Sal took Jill's hand across the table.
We were thinking we'd keep her, if that's okay with you. Of course.
I leaned back, relieved. The dog had been my biggest worry.
I think she'd love that.
Back home, I dragged a suitcase from the top of the wardrobe and began filling it. He shouldn't have told me. That was where he went wrong. If he hadn't told me, it would have all gone just as he'd hoped. But he couldn't have that. It wasn't enough to destroy me, to take my liberty and future from me. His money. No, he wanted to see the look on my face when he did it. He was so desperately insecure. He just had to tell someone his plan, show how clever he was. And he knew he'd miss it in this plan of his. He'd be dead already when I realized that I was going to jail for the rest of my life for something I didn't do. I think the hardest part had been unnecessary in the end, balancing my phone on its edge on the kitchen timer so that when the time ran out, it would fall onto its back and activate the screen when I wasn't there. I don't know if they even checked that. He told me years earlier. He'd been drunk that night. It was in his old flat around the time he'd announced Sal's wedding trust wouldn't pay out for a civil union. He'd been crowing about it, celebrating with a full bottle of 25-year-old whiskey. I'd called him an evil old shit. Then he said it. He might be evil, he'd said, but he was going to make me a murderer. He was going to make sure I went to jail for the rest of my life for his murder. He didn't tell me why, of course, which galls me now. I've always wanted to know why he hated us so much. He could never answer when I asked him. He'd just sneer about how obvious it should be. Perhaps it was just overflow from how much he hated himself. Of course, I'd argued, threatened to call the police first, have him sectioned, but he said he'd deny it and they'd believe him, and I knew he was right. I told him I'd go away, have an alibi. He told me he could wait for the right moment. Mum always encouraged us to stay in touch with him, to check in and see he was all right. She had loved him once, and she had a kind heart. She knew he was broken, and that was why he acted the way he did. But it suited me. I hated him. But I had to stay close enough to watch him, to figure out what he was going to do so I could stop him. I knew the ultimate revenge would be to inherit all his money. He would be turning in his grave like a dynamo if I managed to do that. His problem was he never came to know me the way I came to know him. He spent his life disregarding the thoughts, feelings, and personhood of everyone around him. Whereas for me, growing up with him as a father was like growing up in a cage with a tiger. I knew his every mood, every micro expression, what the tone of his voice meant, when his cruelty would be casual and when it would be vicious, how to temporarily appease him, and when to just try to escape. He told me because he was weak, and therefore he presumed I was weak. Year after year, I kept up regular contact, tolerated his vile character, went shooting with him, listened to his boring stories in which he was always the victor of whatever petty feud he had involved himself in, met with his friends, who were all actually just business partners and as vacuous and cruel as he was, lived an empty, exhausting life of pretense, staying close enough to this monster to watch him. I knew about the cancer. I saw blood in the bowl after he'd used the bathroom. I saw him holding his stomach as if something hurt. And finally, I saw the letter from the consultant, which he'd hidden in one of his usual places. I knew the reason Tara was obsessed with shoelaces was because he had been feeding her the deer tendon cord as a snack for most of her life. And from that, I assumed there would be a booby trap involving it. I noticed when he wouldn't take the gun from me himself that day, and I paid close attention when he painted that window shut. He was forever asking me to open his windows for him. If they dusted for them, they'd find my prints on every single lifter in the house. But I suppose that room was one he couldn't find an excuse to be in with me. It being a tiny bathroom, he thought himself terribly clever. And he was, but also deathly predictable. It wasn't just luck that I picked the right day to go over. The weekend before, I had asked him a question about our plans on Thursday, and he had paused just for a second. And for that second, the mask had slipped, and he had fought a sly smile. Okay, I thought. Something will happen before then. Something that means our Thursday plans won't go ahead. He golfs on Tuesday. The loser pays for lunch the following week, and I knew he'd won the week before. He'd never miss a chance to crow and make a loser pay for an expensive lunch. So, I decided he'd do that first. While he was on the 19th hole, ordering lobster and Bollinger, I was slipping into his house, seeing the huge coil of cord on his desk, and make myself comfortable behind the winged chair in the corner of his study. Tara would have given me away, was giving me away, except that he didn't give a shit about that dog. When she was sniffing and wagging around the chair, I was concealed behind. He merely kicked her and dragged her out of the room. After all, he couldn't have her eating the cord before he was ready. I think he was on a practice run. Surely he'd planned to unbolt the doors before he actually did the deed. He wasn't trying to set up a locked door mystery, just a simple, obvious murder. But he didn't have the time. He'd already gotten the mirrors lined up and angled so we could see the back of his own head. He'd put the gun across the tops of the chairs, the one I was behind and the one beside it, wedged in. I'd held my breath while he stood, fiddling there, getting it aimed just where he wanted it. Then he had gone to sit on his desk and wheeled his chair this way and that, lining up the red dot onto the back of his head. I expect, next, he was going to unlock the doors or open a window, carefully loop the cord, call the dog. but I didn't give him the chance. As usual, he was so obsessively regarding himself, the back of his own head no less, that he didn't even notice me as I slowly stood from my hiding spot. He didn't see me until I appeared, reflected in the bay window. I checked my watch. I'd need to hurry if I was going to make my flight. I went to the bathroom and began loading my shaving gear into my travel bag. The lawyer assures me the Cayman Islands are lovely this time of year. 40 million. I looked up now into my own eyes, reflected in the bathroom mirror. They were part of my inheritance too. My father's grey eyes, piercing with a gleam of cruelty. The will states that I am to give Sal what I think she deserves. And after careful consideration, I have arrived at a figure. 0. She has lived a life, met someone, loved, married. I have spent year after year in the chill of our father's company. I have given everything to the task of stopping his final diabolical plan coming to fruition. I've earned this money. I squared my shoulders, raised my chin, took a last look at myself. Yes. I have earned this. I flicked off the light. I suppose we weren't so very different, after all. He did only tell me so he could see the look on my face. And when he finally noticed me, or rather my reflection, on the pane of glass in the bay window he was facing, standing behind the chair with the rifle in my hands, well, the look on his face was priceless.
This story was written by Beck Stranger and narrated by Ben Chandler. Our Patreon is officially live, so for more stories that haunt, as well as a behind-the-scenes look at what we do and why we do it, please join our Patreon at patreon.com/pleaseleavepod. You can follow Please Leave on Facebook and Instagram at pleaseleavepod. Our email is pleaseleavepod@gmail.com, and our website is pleaseleavepod.com.